Hysteria is brought to you by 3-Day Blinds. There's a better way to build blinds, shades, shutters, and drapery, and it's called 3-Day Blinds. They are the leading manufacturer of high-quality custom window treatments in the U.S., and right now, if you use my URL, 3dayblinds.com/hysteria, they're running a buy one, get one 50% off deal. We can shop for almost anything at home. Why not shop for blinds at home too? 3-Day Blinds has local, professionally trained design consultants who have an average of more than 10 years of experience. Imagine having 10 plus years of experience in blinds. That is called passion. They provide expert guidance on the right blinds for you in the comfort of your home. Just set up an appointment and you'll get a free, no obligation quote the same day. Not very handy. DIY projects can be fun, but measuring and installing blinds can be a big challenge. The expert team at 3-Day Blinds handles all the heavy lifting. They design, measure, and install so you can sit back, relax, and leave it to the pros. The Crooked Office has gotten some upgrades lately, including new blinds from 3-Day Blinds, and I am so excited. Sometimes I'm in a conference room and I just need some privacy. I can't believe I'm saying this about blinds, but I love the 3-Day Blinds in our office. They're so chic and modern, and they keep people from seeing in rooms. Right now, get quality window treatments that fit your budget with 3-Day Blinds. Head to 3dayblinds.com/hysteria for their buy one, get one 50% off deal on custom blinds, shades, and drapery. For a free, no charge, no obligation consultation, just head to 3dayblinds.com/hysteria. One last time, that's buy one, get one 50% off when you head to the number 3dayblinds.com/hysteria. Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Sammy Sage.
Sammy, founder of Betches Media, host of Morning Announcements, and my friend. We're so happy to have you co-hosting today.
Thank you. I feel like I have the tiniest, biggest shoes to fill because, I mean, coming after Alyssa, that's just, I miss her a lot, but I mean, I'm really just happy to be here.
Yeah, well, we're so glad that you're here. I have a question for you. Sammy, what is your favorite unconventional way to cool off when it's so hot that you want to take your skin off?
I don't know how unconventional this is because my dogs do it, but like standing over the air vent or like on a cold slab of stone, if you can find one.
The Monroe, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how unconventional that is. How unconventional are we talking?
I mean, I do like ice in the bra. Like ice, like something right here for some reason, my like sternum area. If I just cool that off, the rest of my body is like, oh, we're all cool now. Like I trick myself.
I think that makes sense because I'm pretty sure, I'm no scientist, no Dr. Fauci, but I'm pretty sure there are some certain pressure points that if you hit them, it like makes a big difference. Like I hear this area on your wrist. Sorry if we're only listening. Mm. Like the inside of your wrists is very important. Like if you put ice there, that actually helps a lot too.
Mm. Okay, RFK Jr.
I mean, I'm not saying it's going to cure cancer, but it may help you cool off momentarily.
All right, today we will be digging into the Trump administration's move to terminate millions of dollars in federal grants for teen pregnancy prevention and what that says about the administration's vision for women. Then we deep dive into Emily Wilson's scathing review of the Odyssey. Plus, Dr. Annie Andrews, Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in South Carolina, stops by to discuss her race and how the death of Lindsey Graham is shaking things up. And as always, we end with Sani Petty. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast that begrudgingly admits that Donald Trump was fucking hilarious at Lindsey Graham's funeral. He was fucking hilarious, Sammy.
Oh,
can we watch the clip? The clip that really put me headed down a rabbit hole and then being like, okay, he's fucking funny. Let's watch this clip.
Our nation needs more men and women like that great person sitting, laying wherever he may be. I think I know where he is, and I think he's up there. I think he's watching us. I'm pretty sure of it.
Oh, my God. Okay.
It's like when he looked at the eclipse.
Yeah.
Same pose.
Sitting, laying.
It's like that. It's that great person. It's giving, like, these amazing females.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's giving that episode of 30 Rock where they try to prefab a song to help the people the thing that happened to. It's like he just had a ChatGPT wrote him just a general obituary. And he just went with it, or a general like honorific speech, and he just went with it. But you had something that you highlighted too from the funeral that was equally, if not more, funny.
Oh, it's when he's like Lindsey Graham was loved by Republicans and Democrats alike. Actually, maybe not. I'm going to go off script for a second here, and then he kind of goes into like, no one loved war more than Lindsey. He was incredibly hawkish. And it was just very, it was very honest. It was fast. I would say in terms of like, if this weren't a funeral, or maybe because it's Lindsey Graham's funeral, the whole thing just felt so deeply unserious, mm-hmm. but Lindsey Graham was an unserious man.
Lindsey Graham was a bad person and now he's dead. And then also as Donald Trump walked past his coffin, he gave it a little double tap. He gave it a little tap.
That was so funny. Like they're there.
Like, but it was also like he was the coach of a team that had just lost, and the star player was like crying on the sidelines. It's like, it's all right, bud. Get up. Gotta get up and go for the next one. It was so funny. And then I don't know if you saw this clip, but there was another clip of him attempting to put a Tic Tac into his own mouth and failing.
Look, the motor skills are not—they're falling apart.
They're not there. They're not there. But it was. Funeral-wise, it was pretty funny.
What I do think is kind of very telling about all of this is that as far as people go who Trump associates with, Lindsey Graham, I feel he hasn't had as much affection for anyone since Jeffrey Epstein as he did for Lindsey Graham. Like, I think he genuinely enjoyed being around Lindsey Graham. And, like, just the way he was talking about him was when he first, like, died, he was like, you know, oh, it's just terrible. But in a way that, like, he wouldn't even speak about his sons that nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And the bar is so low. But at the same time, like, I just feel that there was a real affection between these two men. Mm-hmm. And yet this is how he still treats his funeral.
Yes, absolutely. I think Lindsey, we said in our This Fucking Guy video about Lindsey Graham, which thankfully came out before he died. But the Lindsey Graham video, he has like real like get him boss energy. Like he's not comfortable he could never have been the president because he can't really be a leader. He has to like glom on to a more powerful man and attach himself to that man's butt and then be like, yeah, boss, yeah, yeah, get him. And for a while it was John McCain and now it was Donald Trump. And Donald Trump really loves that energy. Someone who's just attached to his butt being like, yeah. Yeah, boss. Yeah, everything's – you're doing great. You're doing great. So, I mean
– it was perfect.
It was perfect. It was –
he's a small man.
He is a small man. But, yeah, it was a fitting funeral and a fitting tribute to a person who treated war like a video game he was excited about buying. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. More about the Trump administration. The Trump administration is, you know – kind of easy to lose this in the sauce because we've got a never-ending war going on and there's no clear path to it ending in the near future. We've got a bunch of chaos at home. We've got inflation. We've got unaffordability. We've got a president who doesn't seem to have any capacity to handle any problems that Americans actually care about. But in the background, the Trump administration is quietly working to roll back the sexual revolution. And I know that sounds dramatic, but here's a great example of how they're doing it quietly in the background. Okay. The Trump administration has quietly terminated millions of federal grants for teen pregnancy prevention programs, leaving only a handful active. Now, here's something interesting about the birth rate, which I think you and I have discussed, Sammy. The birth rate is going down in the U.S. mostly because teenagers aren't getting pregnant anymore. It's not that
tragedy.
Like, it's not like people are – women in their 40s are having babies way more than they ever have in the past. Women in their 30s, pretty steady. Women in their 20s, it's going down a bit. But the teen pregnancy rate has really bottomed out, and that is kind of the driver of why the birth rate is decreasing. That's actually probably a good thing that the teens are less pregnant than ever, you know?
Right. Well, I just have a question before we start. What kind of sex ed did you receive in like middle school and high school?
Okay, well, I was raised Catholic by parents who were mortified by sex. And so they never they never ever talked to me about it. But I was an encyclopedia kid. So I remember like being like, I've got to figure out what this is because the kids at school are talking about it. So I like read about it in the encyclopedia. And then in eighth grade, And then also, like, I went to CCD. I, like, went to Mass every week. I was, like, a, you know, Sunday school, it was Catholic, you know? And so they didn't really talk about it until we got to be, like, in middle schools. And middle school, high school, they would give, like, presentations about sexual health that were very fear-based. And then okay. In eighth grade, I had, like, a class that was pretty straightforward and explanatory. How about you, Sammy?
We had a condom bowl in high school.
What?
Where you could just take them if you needed from the nurse's office.
Did you ever take them and, like, make balloon animals?
No. I didn't go near the condom bowl because I was not having sex. But if I were, I would have probably done so. But I think my point is that speaks to, like, the very progressive education that we received. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we had, like, sex ed classes, I think, starting in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. And overall, it was, I would say, like, a pretty, like, liberal school. Mm-hmm. We had, like, I had the first openly gay people I knew were my teachers, actually. Mm-hmm. So it was, yeah.
I had, like, a second cousin who was openly gay, and it was just kind of treated as just like, he moved away from rural Wisconsin and moved to San Francisco and was like, yeah, fuck the, I can't deal. But he was, like, out and gay and living in San Francisco, like, before it was something that was, like, accepted by mainstream society. And he was just sort of like, I don't know, my family's, like, pretty Midwestern, where it's like, don't ask, don't tell. Like, not, like, yes. It's just sort of like, yeah, as long as you're not hurting anybody, I don't really care what you're doing. You know, just, like, don't be annoying. And it was kind of,
I think that's a great attitude.
Yeah, it was. But yeah, it was, my sex ed was pretty much brought to you by the World Book Encyclopedia and my seventh and eighth grade, like, family and consumer sciences education teacher, Mrs. Schmidt. And then, like, a very scary film strip that we watched in CCD. But, you know, I didn't have sex in high school either. You know, I really didn't. I felt like I knew enough. I'd seen enough. I was like, you know what? Not for me at this juncture. And right. I felt when it was time for me to when I did go to college and when I did become sexually active, I felt like I knew what right. was going on. There wasn't any, like, scares or, like, what is the, you know, I felt, like, prepared, you know?
Right. Well, that I feel like was a lot of your own initiative. Mm-hmm. But really the question is, like, I think whatever activity anyone's doing in high school, I do think that the components of, like, a healthy or as close as you can get out from, you can't control for what someone's parents do, but, like, in the education space, I think awareness of the risks mm-hmm. and awareness of how to mitigate them, just from, like, an honest scientific standpoint, is the most, and obviously of consent, mm-hmm. is, I think, like, the minimum you should be going into adulthood with. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what a lot of these policies sort of aim to obfuscate to young people, so that you'll only get it if you happen to be in a school and or your parents will teach you that. So it's, I don't know, it's pretty harmful, I think, overall, that there's not this, like, wide awareness.
Yeah.
But I guess if you want more babies...
Yeah, I mean, you know, beyond just pregnancy, I think being armed with knowledge about what's going on with yourself anatomically, what's going on with people that you're sexually attracted to anatomically, and what is consent and what is a normal thing to happen after you have sex and what is not normal and what to look for. And those things prevent, like, health problems and abuse. Like, it is useful for somebody to know, like, oh, okay, if you have sex and then it hurts really, really bad, it's excruciating, that's not, like, normal. Like, you should go to the doctor. You shouldn't have to live like that. You know, if you have sex and then afterwards it burns when you pee, like, you probably should get checked out so that you can knock it out and, like, carry on with your life instead of dealing with some long-standing effects of an infection that's gone unchecked. So I think it's not just about, like, having babies or not having babies. It's just about, like, moving through the world as an organism in a way that isn't terrible and scary and full of fear and pain.
Right. Like, it should be, I think, addressed more scientifically, and then also, like, on the consent and emotional side, mm-hmm. its own thing. But I actually think that what we're saying is very advanced for what, like, is being considered mm-hmm. in a lot of places.
Yeah. I mean, there are some programs that were trying to do that. They were trying to give kids like straightforward information about here's what sex is, here's what your body does, here's what happens. One of those organizations was a South Carolina nonprofit called Fact Forward. The New York Times had a piece on that organization. Fact Forward provides health and sex education classes. The organization found out last week by the Assistant Secretary for Health that their $1.6 million grant was canceled because their work no longer aligned with the administration's priorities. Okay. The department accused them of producing, quote, content that encourages, normalizes, or promotes sexual activity for minors, which is like, I'm just going to pause. That's kind of a wild thing to finger wag by an administration headed by a man who used to be best friends with a dead financier known for promoting sexual activity among minors. But I digress. I feel like
he has his own accusations.
I feel like, you know, the Trump administration, if they're trying to get away from the Epstein thing, they need to, like, get away from talking about minors and sex, period. Just leave that alone, right? You're girl bossing too close to the sun. Well, the claim was vehemently denied by the organization. In fact, the federal grant stipulated that the nonprofit must use courses from a federally approved list the government deemed to be effective and age appropriate. The only people allowed to teach teens about sex are creepy middle-aged men, I guess. Right?
Yeah, I would love to see what they deem to be effective and age appropriate.
Yeah. Okay, so in Trump's first term, the administration targeted an Obama-era $100 million government initiative focused on funding evidence-based programs, like we were discussing, designed to curb teen pregnancy. While the courts did stop that campaign in 2018, the administration is now taking steps to push on the grants again. So what's going on now is a continuation of that gross legacy, but it's also taking things a step further. According to the New York Times, quote, the new criteria say that grant recipients must teach abstinence as the only means to prevent teen pregnancy. Courses must stress the importance of marriage and procreation and instruct young people how to safeguard their fertility. They make scant reference to preventing sexually transmitted infections and virtually none to lesbian, gay, and transgender sexuality. So that's what's going on. And also worth noting that Trump's 2027 budget specifically calls for eliminating teen pregnancies prevention programs because they promote radical leftist ideology.
So it's radically left to not get pregnant before you can even consent, technically?
Well, they're giving young women especially so much conflicting information. It's like, absolutely, do not have sex, do not have sex, do not have sex. But then as soon as you become of age, get married immediately and have sex and be constantly available for your partner. But you don't know how to do it and you don't know anything about it, but you just have to do it over and over and over again and like have a ton of babies. And
the church will teach you how. And the church, that's actually, you'll get marriage classes and the church will teach you how. Like, I think that this is, while we're looking at just this grant being pulled, this is part of a long chain of events that they want to happen and just really like a very small corner of their broader picture that they want to, you know, the broader society that they want to create. Because even their goals are seemingly at odds. They want more people to have babies. They don't want people having sex in order to prevent teen pregnancy, but they know that abstinence only doesn't work and that more babies are had, which they also say they want. But I think the part that they don't say is that they are okay with trapping girls and women in relationships where they have no leverage and no financial power mm-hmm. and doing that as young as possible while indoctrinating them and telling them that this is good, you're happy, you're serving God, probably is like a huge component of this. And that's actually like the piece that doesn't get said.
Yeah. I mean, they want people to get married before their frontal lobes are fully formed, before they can mm-hmm. sit down and be like, wait a minute, what does this mean? What are the implications of this? Like, having a child is forever. Having a child is more durable than being married to somebody. Because if you get divorced and you have no kids, like, bye-bye. Like, that's it. That's over. You have a child with somebody, you are connected to that person for the mm-hmm. rest of – until one or both of you is dead. Like, you are connected with them for the rest of your life.
Well, in their ideal situation, it's just you and them and the kid. And what this actually creates is permission for men to act however they want because mm-hmm. you will be stuck there with the kid and told, don't divorce. It'll ruin your life and your kid's life. And that's why they these types of communities, not like Donald Trump, obviously, and, you know, people like Pete Hegseth get away with it, RFK Jr., whatever, but the people who are being affected by these policies most are probably living in communities where they would be ostracized if they got a divorce, no matter how abusive their husband is. And so, like, that's the part that they're not going to codify in their budget. But that's what actually goes on. And that's why when you, you know, when you outlaw abortions and no-fault divorce, you know, you see suicide rates for women or married women go up. So there's all these, like, factors. And the lowest concern on the ladder is how a woman feels.
It's just, I think they're creating a funnel. They're trying to funnel women into being a dependent class. And by dependent, like, dependent not like parasitic. I mean dependent like a person who can't leave. They physically cannot leave. They do not have the economic ability to leave because they've devoted so much of their time to raising these kids. They don't have the educational background because they've been focused their entire lives on getting married and having kids. They don't have any life skills because what they've done is stay at home and taking care of children. And granted, those are life skills. And I believe that, like, homemaking is real work. And I think that the fact that it is not viewed as, like, economically important and is not viewed as real work is extremely misogynistic. But I think that this is also trying to put women in a position where, like you said, Sammy, they can't leave. They can't leave these men because no matter what the men do. And that creates a sort of environment of entitlement that men will have. And it's offered, this is something that is being sold to young men and old men too in a really gross way as a path back to the lives that their fathers and grandfathers were entitled to with no consideration for the happiness or agency of women. And it's so disturbing. I wanted to talk about something else, Sammy, because we have a lot to get to today. You noticed an interesting trend when we were talking about, like, the push for people to get married younger and start having babies. Where are you seeing that?
So I'm really seeing it in comparison with people my age. So I don't know if you follow, like, the sort of Gen Z New York City influencer crowd on TikTok, on Instagram, you know. So there's, like, this sort of crowd. Are you aware of any of these characters?
Yeah. I mean, since we discussed, I'm like, oh, yeah, that person. There are those people that I've, like, developed this impression of, like, a Gen Z person delivering the news, like, in the voice of all right, besties, today we were in Iran again. It's not going great, but I tried a little hummus and it was really good. Then we moved on. It's like that, you know, that voice, is that, are those people, is that what you're talking about?
It is that, if they would be reporting the news. I'm thinking, like, do you remember when the cut came out with It's Good to Be a West Village Girl?
Yes. Yeah.
It's like that. It's that. So it's that kind of crowd. And I've, this past summer/year, so many of these popular influencers who are between ages like 25 and 29 have gotten married. And I think the reason it stuck out to me is because my friends, and I think kind of not just even like my own friends, but also people who are like millennial influencers, all that they/we all got married like 29 to 34. You know, obviously there was COVID that kind of pushed it back, but even so, it was like a much later. And I'm just wondering, like, is that because of the culture? Is that because it's just very, I think 25 to 29 is a really young range to get married in New York City for women who are upwardly mobile. And I just think it's very, very interesting that while this is all happening and we're sort of having this conservative backlash, I guess, living in the most progressive cities in the world, you have this group of very influential people who are not like living outwardly a traditional lifestyle, but they're getting married really young. And my question is, like, is that being influenced by this broader cultural thing? Or is this just sort of an incentive? Are they incentivized to get married because they share and monetize their life online? So if you are, you know, this, it's almost like this sort of reverse incentive mm-hmm. to get married.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. Because I think some people, when I see like an influencer who's young getting married, or like even somebody who's not an influencer get married, I have like people that I know on that I grew up with or whatever, who have like 200 followers, which is a totally normal amount of followers for a normal person to have, but who somehow like have taken on this influencer cadence. Like they present their mm-hmm. lives as though they are influencers. And I sometimes feel like people just get married because they're bored and they're like, well, I want some professional photography done of me and I want to like get a spray tan and I want to wear a white dress. And like, I guess I've had this boyfriend for a few years, so we might as well do it. And like, I think that some of these people are just like, okay, well, I need more content. I'm young and beautiful and I can like wear a beautiful dress and I bet people will help sponsor my wedding and I bet I'll get a bunch more followers. But I also think that it's maybe taking off a bit because I harp on this, but I do think that there are some forces in the media, especially in social media, that are trying to artificially inflate the popularity of getting married young because it's part of a like conservative movement to try to push young women to get married young, especially young educated women. Because, and by educated, right. I mean like mostly white women, because the people that the Trump administration and Project 2025 want to have children and feel like actually deserve to have children / must have children are white educated women. The women who like escaped the subservience of their grandmothers, they want them back. They want them back into the like the clutches of conservatism and domesticity and not have it be their choice. Have it be like, well, I guess this is what everybody's doing, so I'm going to follow the trend.
Honestly, I would be lying if I said that that influence isn't a real thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I do think that what's normal and common just becomes whether it just sort of makes you think less hard about it mm-hmm. or think that something that you might instinctually not want to do is not that big of a deal.
I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong. Like, I don't think getting married young is inherently bad. Like, my brother and his wife have been married since, like, they were both, like, 21 and 22, and they got married because he was about to go to law school. And it was like, all right, we've been together for 4 years. We get married now, or we get married after law school, and we'll have been together for 7 years, and we want our life to get started. They're still together. They're still happy. Like, that is a thing that happens. But I don't think that that's the norm. Even among their friends, they were sort of like among the first to get married. Among my friends from college, I think the first to get married got married when we were like 23. And then the last to get married, one of in our like group of friends, she's engaged and is getting married next summer. So she'll be like 41. So it's like, you know, there's a huge range. And I feel like everyone, this is, I know, a small sample size, but I feel like everyone in my group of friends kind of went into it clear-eyed because there's so many different examples of ways that a life can go. And they made a choice based on how they fit into what was out there. And I think, I don't know that things were being pushed on us when we were, as like young millennials. I never felt like, uh-oh, you better get married, you better get married, you better get married. And I think that now it's out there in a way that it hasn't been out there since like the 80s.
I agree with that. I think, okay, first of all, there is this sort of bias inherently that we're thinking of people getting married because you notice people getting married. Mm-hmm. There's no like big sign, I'm not getting married, I'm not getting married. Mm-hmm. Like every, you know, so you're thinking about things in terms of things that you see happen. So there's that cognitive bias. I think that like when, okay, it's almost like throughout my 20s, the pressure to get married younger almost lessened like as I was getting older. Mm-hmm. So it was like when I was 20, I wanted to get married by like 26. Mm-hmm. By the time
so
I was 26.
Did I. What was I thinking?
But that just seemed like a good time.
Right.
That just seemed like that because maybe like our mothers got married around then. Mm-hmm. And that seemed like 5 years after college when you're 21, 5 years after college feels so long. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I'll date for 2 years and then I'll be engaged for it. You know what I mean? It just seems like the right amount of time. So I don't think that's that crazy. But by the time I was like 25, the idea of being married at 26, even if I were with, was just like, oh, that didn't need to be that soon.
Right.
And I think that was like a cultural norm. Now you're seeing that number come down again. And I don't know. I remember at one point feeling like people who got married at 26 were like child brides.
I mean, I think I don't know if what we're seeing on social media is a reflection of what's actually happening, because for the last, like, I don't know, years and years and years, the age at which people get married for the first time on average has been ticking upward and upward and upward. And I don't think that influencers might, like, it might influence a few people to think about getting married before they would actually get married. But I don't know if it's going to, like, reverse a trend. Because I do think that the horse has left the barn when it comes to the ways that marriage doesn't serve women in American society. And there's actually been some interesting work on this by an economist named Claudia Golden. Claudia Golden did research into women's labor, and she found that societies in which men take on more of the labor inside the home lead to higher fertility rates. And in societies where men do less, fertility rates are lower. So in other words, the reason that women don't necessarily want to get married and procreate are because the act of procreation is super risky for a woman, like physically risky, in terms of like what your responsibilities will be after the baby is born, what you can just get, a man can just leave, you know, and you can't really just like, people do, but you're not, it's not as common. Like women, you can't just like leave your baby. You can't just leave the biological impact that it's had. So women don't want to take that risk unless they're pretty sure that the guy that they're taking the risk with is not going to leave them holding everything.
Right. I mean, the biological influence is undeniable because they're not going to breastfeed. You know, they're not what I think it's pretty instinctual that a woman who's pregnant is at their most vulnerable. And men are, you know, pregnant women are more likely to be murdered by their husbands, not to make things bleak. But I think that the reason that it makes sense that men who are more helpful, that there's like higher fertility rates in those situations, is because men doing things is hot, like evolutionarily.
Right.
That's, if we're talking about like the basis biology here, yeah, a man who can provide, quote unquote, and protect and take on their share of the labor is attractive. Mm-hmm. And you want to have more kids with them, I think.
I mean, I'm just going to say in my situation, we had our first daughter, and after we had her, I really wanted to have a second one, in part because my husband's such a good dad. He's like such a good dad. I was like, of course. Like, first of all, I don't want this kid to be alone at my funeral. That was my like thing. I was like, she needs to have somebody to sit with when her last parent dies. I don't want her to be by herself cleaning out my house. You know what I mean?
Oh my gosh.
I know.
It's really heartening to hear that, because, you know, you don't always hear that.
Yeah.
Not about the funeral.
Right. Well, I really wanted to, I mean, like, look, no marriage is perfect. No person is perfect. And when you're trying to share a life with someone, there's always going to be some tension. But something that I really appreciated about him and continue to appreciate is he's just like super hands-on. Like and sometimes he'll miss things. I think that it's just the difference between men and women is that expectations that women have of marriage have changed, because they've been like, wait, why are we accepting this? Why are we accepting that we come home from work and then have to do all the work at home? And men have been like, okay, I'm done with work. I get to be at home. And like I've said before, women don't want their mother's lives and men do want their father's lives. And so in order for like a marriage in the modern era to work and not be like infuriating for a woman, the man needs to make some conscious decisions to do more than was normal for his father's generation, even if he's got a good dad. You know what I mean? Like, they just have to make a conscious decision. And that, like, is a bit of a pain in the ass. Like, wouldn't it be nice to just, like, not have to do stuff around the house? You have to make a decision to make your life a little bit harder if you want a woman to be like, okay, I'll make my life a lot harder to be with you.
Well, to going back to what you originally said, the thing that is made invisible is that a woman's work, housework, childcare, all of that is a very full-time job, multiple full-time jobs, arguably, because I know plenty of very rich people who hire staff that includes a nanny and a housekeeper. It's like, those are multiple things. And it used to all just fall on the wife. So if you think about that, that's what's invisible. And so men, I think that's, you know, you can speak to like inequality. You have the very wealthy who are essentially outsourcing all of that. Mm-hmm. And then their wife can sort of be, you know, mm-hmm. this status symbol wife. Yeah. And then they can get that life.
Yeah. Caitlin Flanagan got a lot of flack by writing an article many years back about how, like, wealthy feminists, educated women were, like, outsourcing a lot of the domestic labor in their home. But, yeah, that's one of the great—
Fact.
Yeah.
It is a fact. I mean, it's not— Is it not true?
Yeah. I mean, it's—
Did she get flack for saying that?
Well, Caitlin Flanagan can be a little bit of an eye poker. Like, I appreciate that about her. I don't agree with her all the time, but I'm like, okay, I see what you're trying to do, Caitlin. Okay, speaking of men, somebody recently had the great idea that maybe we should pay more attention to men, you know? Mm. Last week, Democratic Senator Ruben Gallego, along with Roger Marshall, who's a Republican from Kentucky, introduced a bill to the Senate floor that aims to improve men's health. Finally, someone's going to study men's health. What a great idea. The bill directs the U.S. Government Accountability Office to study the state of men's health in the country. Here's a direct quote from the press release. Men are facing a growing health crisis and dying earlier from preventable conditions like cancer, heart disease, and mental health struggles. Instead of letting men continue to struggle alone in silence, this bill would establish an Office of Men's Health to promote preventative care and life-saving research. When we invest in men's health, we build stronger families and stronger communities. No, just make the men take home ec. That's what, like, I feel like part of the reason men are struggling is because what a lot of, in the past, they would get married and then their wife would be like, go to the doctor. I'm going to schedule the appointment for you. I'm going to make sure you're doing this. I'm going to feed you healthy foods. And like, no, men need to develop self-sufficiency. I'm sorry. I like jumped in right away because it was making me mad. But Sammy, what do you have to say about this?
No, I mean, if they're struggling alone in silence, like, no one has ever... If we don't have one thing, it's people telling men to shut up enough. So let them talk. No one's stopping you. You have all the chance.
Right.
So, you know, we let them. I don't know. It's just so annoying because all health studies before, like, the 90s were
men.
About men.
Were about
so
men.
So everything... I don't know. Like, sorry you guys aren't getting enough attention.
I mean, here's a good example of, like, okay, acknowledging that there is a problem among men, the solution isn't to pour more money into researching men's health, which is the thing that has been studied for the last, like, 100 years, right? The solution is to figure out why men can't take care of themselves. Like, you know what I mean? It's not like, it's like, okay, so it sounds like they're just not taking care of themselves. So why? Are they raised with a sense of helplessness? Are they raised to be taken care of? I don't think they're being raised all the way. I think that they need to be raised to be self-sufficient people who can survive on their own and who, when they're in a household with someone else, whether it's a roommate, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, whatever, they should be a contributor to the household. And if for some reason the other half of their household goes away, they should be capable of making themselves a sandwich. It's not that complicated. And like vacuuming their own floors. They should know how to like deep clean the tub. It's not that hard. It's not that
Especially hard. Especially because like, you know, they can figure it out. Like they can figure out catching a fish somehow, apparently. I'm sure they can figure out how to operate a vacuum.
Maybe we could make vacuums a little bit more butch. You know, like how we made yogurt butch?
They're pretty butch.
We could, I know, but we could like put flames on the side of them or something and paint them black and call it like.
They're called shark.
Call it like a dude.
Called shark.
Yeah, but call it like a dude vacuum or something or like flaming shark or flaming hot shark. vacuum for men.
Remember, you know, all those ads that are like a woman vacuuming from like the 50s? Like those, it could be like that, but it's like liquid death vacuum.
Yeah, totally. I think we just need to make it like an extreme vacuum, like Monster energy drink, but a vacuum.
You know what? This is why I think such sentiments like boys will be boys are so harmful, because when you raise men with very low expectations, you're going to get very low behavior. And I know there's this sort of backlash among, I guess maybe it's like millennial and Gen Z men who are sort of resentful because when they were growing up, it was like all about girl power. And so they felt like they were ignored. I know that's like a lot that's behind the like male loneliness epidemic. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what you like. On some level, this is psychological. This is like a mass psychology problem. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know how you revert to like a man of honor that isn't also like needing to be above women.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you solve that problem.
I mean, I think just using
a person of honor,
a person just of people. Honor. I think that there's like, I think that men should be raised, and this will contribute to overall men's health, because like raised with a sense of personal responsibility for themselves and self-sufficiency, where it's like, it is not anybody else's job to take care of you. But like, if you can take care of yourself, you can help take care of other people. And other people who are capable of taking care of themselves can also help you when you need a hand. But like, you mm-hmm. need to be capable of doing it on your own for the most part, you yes. know? Eventually you'll need support. And then you can feel free to support each other. You can be a support to other people. Like, you, instead of being somebody who just expects to be cared for, expects to be looked after, expects to be reminded to go to the doctor, and expects to be catered to. Like, here's an example that I think is why we're kind of we're scoffing at this, like, oh, we should spend more money on men's health. Like, obviously, we want everybody to be well. But like, let's take PCOS, for example. It's a condition that affects 10 to 13% of women worldwide. 70% don't. Oh, you have it? Wow.
Yeah. And I was like late diagnosed because you don't.
We don't know anything. It's like
you didn't know anything about it.
Where doctors yeah. are like, I
and
don't
so
know.
Is my mom.
It could be yeah. anything. But 70% mm-hmm. of women don't even know they have it. So
yeah.
it was just this year that they renamed it to polyendocrine metabolic ovarian syndrome, or PMOS, to help doctors understand what women are experiencing and give a proper diagnosis. And endometriosis affects 1 in 10 women and is still famously understudied. I believe one study into endometriosis looked into the attractiveness of women with endometriosis. Yeah.
Very important.
Yeah. I feel like this bill reads as very tone deaf. And also, you know, look, Dem's in disarray, but let's not forget the reporting accusing Ruben Gallego of having romantic relationships with his staff. The ethics committee dismissed the allegations, but where, you know, look, he spent an awful lot of time around Eric Swalwell. I don't know that he should be like, let's pay more attention to the men right now. Again, like maybe girl bossing too close to the sun.
You know, I don't care that Ruben Gallego's a Democrat. I'm not advocating he get kicked out of Congress or anything, mm-hmm. but I think he is not the greatest. I'm just going to say that. And I think he's an example of how men basically, they meet the standard that you put them mm-hmm. at. Mm-hmm. And I think he's like a really good example of that.
Mm-hmm. I think nobody benefits more from awful men than like medium awful men. Like there, yeah. like I remember when.
So true.
I remember during so Me Too. True. I remember during Me Too when, like, you know, there were this kind of smattering of stories that came out that just kind of explored a range of offenses and a range of harms done by powerful men to less powerful, usually women, sometimes other men. And I remember like a lot of times the pushback I would get. I mean, the Aziz Ansari story is like a great example where it's like, yeah, he sounds like he was like he had a shitty date. The story was written in a really like weird way. But people were like, oh, the whole Me Too movement should be like dismissed because it's not like he was Harvey Weinstein. Like the existence of Harvey Weinstein made it so the bar that anybody had to meet to be considered terrible was impossible, like monstrously high. And I think that like, you know, somebody like Ruben Gallego has benefited from the fact that there's an Eric Swalwell out there. And I don't think we should lose track of that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Dr. Annie Andrews, candidate for Senate in South Carolina, joins me. Hysteria is brought to you by Smalls. Oh, man, my cat lived to be about the same age as the rapper Exhibit's cat. The rapper's cat is going viral for being 20. Mine lived to be 21 years old. She was a true Methuselah. She was an icon. She was a dame. And one of the reasons that she lived as long as she did was because I fed her better food than I could feed myself sometimes. During my lean years, she ate like a queen and I ate ramen. We love our little guys, but we don't when we have to deal with scarf, barf, or itchy furs. That's why we choose Smalls to ensure a balanced diet and healthy cats. Smalls fresh cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free, 100% human-grade ingredients you'd find in your fridge, and it's delivered right to your door. A balanced diet leads to less shedding, fewer hairballs, and more silky shine. More of the nutrients in Smalls food are digestible, so less junk comes out the other end. That means less stinky poops. Smalls cat food leads to high protein and improved hydration. That equals strong bones and toned muscles. Again, feeding your cat the right food is what leads you to having a Methuselah cat. Eleanor was an absolute icon, and I owe it in part to the quality of the food that I fed her. Forbes ranks Smalls the best overall cat food, and BuzzFeed says, my cats went completely ballistic for this stuff. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. Are you spooked by commitment? You can try Smalls risk-free. They'll refund you if your cat won't eat their food. And cats can be true jerks about food changes. I never, ever had a problem getting Eleanor to enjoy her Smalls. So stop serving your little carnivore a bowl of processed shortcuts for a limited time, because you are a Hysteria listener. Get 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/hysteria. That's 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/hysteria. Hysteria is brought to you by Jones Road Beauty. I am on camera a lot for work. We are pivoting to video again, kids. And I always like to keep some makeup on hand to keep myself looking fresh. You never know when somebody's going to say something dumb and I'm going to have to talk about it into a microphone. I used to need to keep a heavy makeup bag full of messy products in order to get my desired look, but now my routine uses a fraction of the products and time. That's because I have the Jones Road Miracle Balm. It simplifies the steps without sacrificing the look. It's the ultimate no-fuss multitask. I use it as a highlighter, bronzer, blush, lip tint, etc. to get a glowy look in under 60 seconds. And now I never have to worry about that caked on look. It's just my skin, but better. I wear it before every Hysteria recording, so you've definitely seen it in action. My favorite part is that it's actually good for my skin. Every Jones Road formula is packed with skin-loving ingredients and none of the junk. Once I started simplifying my routine with Miracle Balm, I realized some days I want a little more coverage, just without going back to a full complicated makeup routine. And Jones Road just launched their foundation stick that fits perfectly into that. It's a foundation stick that even foundation skeptics will love. This skincare forward foundation delivers buildable, real coverage while feeling completely weightless on your skin. You'll love how it gives you medium to full coverage without ever looking heavy. It's dermatologist tested and packed with skin-loving ingredients to nourish while you wear it. And the finish is just really natural, not too matte, not too dewy, just smooth, even, healthy-looking skin. It's available in 30 shades to match a wide range of skin tones. Modern-day makeup that's clean, strategic, and multifunctional for effortless routines. For a limited time, our listeners are getting a free full-size mascara on their first purchase when they use code HYS at checkout. Just head to jonesroadbeauty.com and use code HYS at checkout. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people who believe that hope is as contagious as measles. Joining me today, we have one of the most exciting Democrats running for Senate this midterm cycle. Her whole race has just been turned upside down by some unexpected events. So in studio, all the way from South Carolina, Dr. Annie Andrews. Welcome to Hysteria.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
So you're not a career politician. You're a doctor. But you threw your hat in the ring to run for Senate. Like, what prompted you to make that jump? Have you always kind of had it in the back of your mind?
No. And if you knew me in college, you would have never predicted that this is where my life would take me. I knew when I was 4 years old, I wanted to be a doctor, and my whole life revolved around achieving that goal, practicing as a pediatrician. But after 15 years of understanding the impacts of policies on my patients and their families, I started to understand the importance of politics, engaging in politics on behalf of America's children and their families. So I got off the sidelines actually after the Parkland shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. I joined Moms Demand Action.
Oh.
And joining that organization really helped me understand the value of my voice. And it just all snowballed from there. I ran in 2022 against Nancy Mace in South Carolina's first congressional district. Learned a lot through that experience. Mm-hmm. Never planned to run for office again. But I actually decided to get in this race the day RFK Jr. was nominated to lead HHS, speaking of the measles.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, let's talk about your background as a physician. Mm-hmm. How does it inform your policy priorities?
It really is my entire worldview is from my 20 years working on the front lines of America's broken healthcare system. So I'm a hospital-based pediatrician. I take care of sick and injured children in the hospital setting. And I would go to work and take care of kids who, when they go home, their parents don't know where their next meal is coming from. Kids that I would diagnose with new common chronic diseases like asthma or diabetes. And while I explain the treatment plan to the families, they have to ask me, how much is that inhaler going to cost? Or how much is that insulin going to cost? Kids who get admitted in the throes of mental health crises, whose families have been desperately looking for mental health resources in their communities but haven't been able to find them. In every children's hospital in every state in this country tonight, there will be kids who have to spend the night in their hospital room alone because their parents have to leave their sick child's bedside to go work their third shift job just so they can make ends meet. And then, of course, like most pediatricians in this country, I have cared for children who have been shot. Mm-hmm. So all of those are policy failures. And as a pediatrician, I understood that I had agency, I had this lived experience, and I could apply it to, you know, advocacy first. And then once I realized talking to lawmakers who don't inherently care about America's children was not a path to catalyze change, I understood we have to elect people who inherently care about the issues we care about if we really want to see change.
Mm-hmm. What's the energy like on the ground? Like, what are any favorite moments from the campaign?
Yes, the vibes are incredible in South Carolina right now.
Okay.
Things are changing. Things are shifting. One of my favorite moments was in the upstate in Greenville, South Carolina, which is inherently thought of as being a really deep red part of the state. We had an event at a record store. We were supposed to be in this small little annex part of the record store. We showed up and it was already a problem for the fire department. And we ended up just moving the event to the parking lot. We were expecting 30 people and over 200 people showed up.
Wow.
People in South Carolina are tired of a broken Washington, D.C. They're excited to have someone who represents generational change, someone who speaks plainly, someone who acts like a regular person because I am a regular person and is fighting for all the things that we care about. And so we've been building a people power movement all across the state for over a year now. And so we are in a really good position, given the current situation in my race, to win in November.
Mm-hmm. Well, how has your strategy shifted since your opponent's sudden death? Like Darlene Graham, she's never served in political office before, so she's kind of an unknown quantity. How are you taking that on?
Yeah. So, you know, what I've been saying is who I'm running against has changed, but who I'm running for hasn't changed. All the problems South Carolinians are facing didn't change when Lindsey Graham died. And my mission and the reasons I got off the sidelines haven't changed. So really what changes is that now I'm in this unique opportunity to run unopposed for the next 4 to 5 weeks, depending on if this primary goes to a runoff. Mm-hmm. I likely won't know who my opponent is until the end of August. So now I've won my primary decisively. I'm talking to a general electorate. I'm talking to Republicans, Democrats, and independents mm-hmm. about my vision for the future of South Carolina while these Republicans fight it out. It's going to be a GOP civil war on the ground in South Carolina because people are not happy with this appointment turning into what looks like an anointment of Lindsey Graham's sister because there's a lot of Republicans in waiting who have a lot of ambition and they saw this as an opportunity to get that Senate seat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they probably don't want a Nepo baby.
No, nobody wants a Nepo baby.
Right. It's like a Nepo baby situation. Well, and Graham had taken many, many deeply unpopular positions, even within his own party. Why was he able to win elections by such wide margins for so long?
You know, he hadn't won an election since 2020, and so much has changed since then. You know, but people have their typical partisan voting patterns in South Carolina. There are a lot of people who really cannot ever imagine voting for a Democrat. But what has happened, you know, since Trump came back into office is people are really living the negative impacts of these failed policies coming from this failing administration. Mm-hmm. And so what we were seeing in our polling that showed me neck and neck in a statistical tie with Lindsey Graham and, you know, getting 1 out of 5 non-MAGA Republicans to vote for me and getting a wide margin with independents voting for me was just people are dissatisfied with what's coming from this Trump administration. Mm-hmm. And so yes, historically, South Carolina has voted red in presidential elections. We haven't had a Democratic senator since the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. But 2026 is not like an average election cycle. This isn't American politics as usual. People mm-hmm. are ready. You know, there's an anti-incumbency sentiment out there. There's an outsider. We want to send outsiders to Washington, D.C., and that's what I represent. And, you know, our healthcare system is deeply flawed and broken, and that is an urgent problem. And I just can't think of a better time to send. I'd be the first ever pediatrician senator. And I can go up there and go toe-to-toe with RFK Jr.
Oh, my goodness. What would you ask RFK Jr.?
Oh, so many things.
What would be the meanest question that you would ask RFK Jr.?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, this is like a nerdy joke, but I'm dying for a reporter to ask him what a p-value is, because that is like a very basic statistical principle that he clearly does not understand. And he's over there like shifting funds from the NIH to study things that have already been studied to answer unanswerable or already answered questions. And he has like no understanding of what it means to like actually plan a research project. And I just want him to be exposed for the grifter and conspiracy theorist and fool that he is.
Okay. That is pretty mean, but mean but true. So you don't want to be a career politician. Why does that make you a strong candidate?
Because, you know, and I know a lot of people say that. They say they're going to run on term limits. I mean, Lindsey Graham ran on term limits when he was first elected when I was in eighth grade. But I actually mean it because I have a job that I love. I love being a pediatrician. It is the best career. But now I understand politics is a path to most efficiently and effectively solve my patients' problems. I want to go up there and serve two terms, work really hard for 12 years, and then go back to the career that I love.
Mm-hmm. And then your patients would call you Dr. Senator.
That's right. Senator, doctor, Senator, doctor. Whatever.
A couple of fun questions before we wrap. In one of your campaign ads, you mentioned that you watch Bluey with your kids. I have two kids who also watch Bluey, so I know that's like a parent and kid activity. What's your favorite Bluey episode?
Oh, gosh, that's such a good question. I mean, I've seen all of them like five times. I heard that they just released them like as longer episodes so you don't have to sit through the intro every time. Have you heard that?
Oh, my God.
It's like a game changer that for those of us who watch episode after episode after episode.
The theme song haunts me.
It's so good. I consider Bluey to be a parenting show that children will watch. And it's just so amazing. I mean, gosh, I don't even know what my favorite episode is. What's your favorite episode?
I think Sleepy Time.
Oh, yes. Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. When they're floating in space.
And it's a dream sequence. And then at the end, I'm crying for some reason. I'm like, what is this? It's really good. And then the rain one. That's a good one.
It makes me want to be a better parent. That's for sure.
I know. It makes me feel slightly insufficient. But then I'm like, no, they're only parenting. What's
7 minutes?
7 minutes at a time.
Right.
So maybe that's how I can think about parenting. Okay. I'm going to show a photo of you that you've used in your campaign materials. This is you as a little kid. Okay. I have questions about this haircut. Did achieving this haircut involve a bowl?
I look like a lamp in that picture. That is an aggressive
little lamp,
1980s bowl cut. The funny thing is my youngest daughter like has my face. Like she has that face, but she has a normal haircut. And now I see what would have been possible when I was, I think, 6 or 7. There was not a bowl used in achieving this look, but I think that they nailed it.
Yeah. No, it's perfect. Not a hair out of place. Wigs could never.
Nope. Could never.
All right. South Carolina is one of four states I've actually never visited. So if I were to visit South Carolina, where would you send me? What's your favorite? What are your favorite things about your state?
Yeah, so you got to come to the low country first. You have to go to the beach. You have to eat oysters, raw oysters. Are you willing to do
that?
Love
oysters.
Okay, that's great. You should go to Bowen's Island, which is on James Island. It's like a hole in the wall, but you can sit out on the porch and watch dolphins swimming while you eat your fried shrimp. It's amazing. But then you also have to go to the upstate, because that's one of the most amazing things about South Carolina is the beaches right there. And then just 3.5 hours away, you're in the mountains, in the foothills of the Western North Carolina mountains. So in the Greenville area, Traveler's Rest is a fun little town with lots of breweries and shops, and you can see the mountains, go on a hike. So that's what I would recommend.
Amazing. Those are two things that I love doing. And then finally, how can our listeners support your campaign?
Yes, they can go to drannieandrews.com. They can sign up to volunteer. You can phone bank and text bank from anywhere. They can also donate. You know, we have a people-powered movement. Our average donation is $26. We don't take corporate PAC money, and we've raised over $11 million. So we are in a position to win, but it's going to take people from all across the country believing that it's possible. I also like to say I'm a cheap date. It doesn't cost a lot to run a robust campaign in a state like South Carolina, so it's a smart investment. And if we as Democrats ever want to reliably expand the Senate map, that's going to take investment in the South. And no better opportunity to invest in the South than this year when we have this unexpected open Senate seat and a candidate like me who's put in the work to build a winning campaign.
Dr. Annie Andrews, thank you so much for joining us and good luck in the general.
Thank you so much.
Hysteria is brought to you by Hexclad. All right, ladies, summer's officially here. And if you're upgrading anything this season, let it be your kitchen, because summer cooking moves fast. Easy dinners, last-minute guests, backyard meals, and cookware that needs to keep up with all of it. So if you're still using those scratched, peeling, mismatched pans you've been hanging on to for way too long, this is your sign to finally upgrade. Because the last thing you need this summer is food sticking, pans burning, or spending forever at the sink when you could be outside enjoying the evening. Hexclad combines the performance of stainless steel with the convenience of nonstick, so you don't have to choose. You get incredible heat control, a proper sear, and easy cleanup every time. Most cookware makes you compromise. Nonstick wears out fast and scratches easily. Stainless steel performs beautifully, but cleanup can be a nightmare. Hexclad gives you both performance and convenience. I love Hexclad pans. My husband and I have this ongoing tug of war in our house. he's a nonstick guy. I'm a we need to use the best version of pans person. But stainless steel, which I used one time to prove a point and ended up bent over the sink for like 30 minutes twice, two sessions of 30 minutes to get that thing clean. Hexclad really is the best of both worlds. It's oven safe up to 900 degrees, which is amazing. It also has stay cool stainless steel handles, so you're not grabbing a scorching hot pan handle every time you cook. As somebody who serially burns herself, this is great. With over a million customers and over 50,000 five-star reviews, the secret is out. There's a reason Gordon Ramsay uses Hexclad at home and in his restaurants, and he's the toughest critic on the planet. All Hexclad products come with a lifetime warranty. It's literally the last set of pots and pans you'll ever have to buy. So, whether you're hosting all summer long or just want to make everyday cooking feel easier, this is the upgrade your kitchen deserves. For a limited time, our listeners get 10% off with our exclusive link. Just head to hexclad.com/hysteria. Support our show and check them out at hexclad.com/hysteria. Make sure to let them know we sent you. Hysteria is brought to you by Nutrafol. Summer is full of vacations, weekend getaways, and spending more time outdoors. And when you're packing for a trip, the last thing you want is to be worrying about your hair. That's one reason I've loved having Nutrafol as part of my routine. It's helped me feel more confident about my hair, whether I'm headed to the beach, exploring a new city, or just enjoying a long weekend away. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement brand. And it's the number one hair growth supplement brand personally used by dermatologists. Nutrafol's hair growth supplements are peer-reviewed, NSF-certified for sport, and clinically tested. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Nutrafol offers multiple formulas for men and women tailored to different life stages like postpartum or menopause and lifestyle factors such as a plant-based diet, so you get support that's actually right for you. Adding Nutrafol to your daily routine is so easy. Order online, no prescription needed, with automated deliveries and free shipping to keep you on track. Plus, with the Nutrafol subscription, you can save up to 20% and get added perks like a free Headspace membership to support your hair health journey. Let your hair become one less thing taking up space in your head and see thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding in just 3 to 6 months with Nutrafol. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you visit Nutrafol.com and enter promo code Hysteria10. That's Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code Hysteria10. And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast that always passes the Bechdel test. It's just women talking to each other, sometimes about men.
Yeah, I would say that it should be renamed. Now, I don't want to take away a woman's name, but, you know, there could be a different test, the hysteria test.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
We'll come up with what it's testing at some time.
Oh, man. I think we've only had like two men on this podcast in all of its history. And I'm kind of like, should we loosen that rule and sometimes let men on and just grill them?
I think it has to be really case by case. Like, if you genuinely want to do it, yes, but I wouldn't make it a thing to make it a thing.
Yeah. No, I gotcha.
I do think, and this will come up later, that you could do a variation on this fucking guy, which is this fucking girl, and you uncover the women behind the famous men who, and basically like show how they really had, like, they would really wouldn't be anywhere without their wife. You know that saying, like,
so, like,
behind
she's
every,
like that fucking girl, like it's that girl. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I like that. Well, let's ideate more on this after we're done recording this episode, because I like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, speaking of stories that center men, although The Odyssey has been out now for almost 2 weeks, and it continues to dominate discourse online. And in just about every conversation that I have in the office, I feel like I'm one of the last Americans who hasn't seen it. But like, as you know, I've got two little kids at home. I get home from work and I'm immediately doing feeding them and putting them. They have to eat like every day, children.
It's
like multiple times.
Three times.
You have to keep feeding them. And then you have to like give them, you have to clean them and stuff. Anyway, it takes a lot of time. So I haven't had a chance to go to the movies, and I kind of want to wait until like we have a babysitter so that I can go with my husband.
It's
like,
long.
Yeah. That's fine. So is the source material. So like everyone else, we're not done talking about it. I specifically wanted to talk about Emily Wilson's review of the film. Emily Wilson is a professor of classical studies at UPenn, and she wrote a 2017 translation of The Odyssey that Christopher Nolan is said to have taken some inspiration from. Apparently it's flying off the shelves right now. So congratulate, like a rare moment for a classics professor to just like really shine. Like,
maybe
this
I'll get it.
This is like the time for like high school English teachers and classics professors and people who speak Greek to just like really, to really let it fly.
Maybe we could reverse the literacy crisis.
I mean, maybe. I kind of love that they're using like this classical work of literature as the inspiration for this blockbuster giant film. Well, Emily Wilson wasn't the biggest fan of the film. Her review was scathing, and that's maybe an understatement. I love a takedown, so I devoured this even though I haven't seen the movie. I still will see the movie, and I will probably like the movie. But I also, like, even things that I like, sometimes I love to read someone just shit on it.
Me too.
Yeah.
What do you think that's about?
I don't know. But, like, a restaurant that I like, if I read, like, a takedown of the restaurant, I'm like, yes, like, please, give it to me. A movie I love. I love a takedown. A musician, a writer. I don't
Same.
Know.
It's just, like, I kind of like hearing all the opinions, like, and it's not like I am personally offended.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's like, yeah, okay, we can dislike things that other people like. I don't feel like my yum is ever yucked, you know?
Correct.
Like
I
just, I think everyone has I kind of like it when people just let it fly, and especially if they're like kind of mad, because I think people when they're creative, when they're mad, I just love it. I love it.
I agree. And also sometimes things that you like, you also dislike a little.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Okay, so here's some things that Emily Wilson said about Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. I would be ashamed to have written any part of this script. The film lacks psychological, emotional, and political and ethical depth. Its narrative structure is gimmicky. The writing is abysmal. None of the characters has convincing motivation for their actions or words. There are no sex scenes, and all the food looks horrible.
I laughed out loud at that. All the food looks horrible.
All the food looks horrible. That's so funny because sometimes when I read things that are like old text and they describe the food, I always picture it being so good.
Right. Right, it's like a cartoon level of good.
Yeah, yeah, it's like when you watch.
But it probably didn't look that good.
I mean,
be honest.
Maybe, but they also were cooking with. They didn't have seed oils, so you know that they were using whole foods. Like it was probably it's Greece.
But did it look good?
Yeah.
Were they plating it nicely?
Maybe. I mean, it's Greece, and so they have this kind of like plethora of amazing ingredients to use, and like some of them are colorful. So olives.
I wish we could see it.
I know. Mm. You know what? I'm kind of peckish right now. I should probably eat.
Yeah.
another thing that Wilson wrote is, it's family-friendly audiovisual spectacle, like an elaborate 4th of July fireworks display, and with about the same level of narrative and emotional depth.
I agreed with that.
Yeah.
Fine.
My eyes stayed dry even for Argos the dog, whose adorableness as a puppy is predictably amped up to suit our animal-loving times. If only the human characters had been treated with such serious attention. Okay, there's more, but I really want to encourage everybody to read this Emily Wilson review, even if you liked the movie. People were so obsessed with the review that it crashed the London Review of Books website for a period of time, and I had to read an archived version of it. Okay. So, Sammy, you've seen the movie. I haven't. I've just read the review and been like, still going to see the movie. The review is called An Uncomplicated Man. Does the title fit?
Absolutely. I first of all, I want to say I loved the movie. And I still, this review, I agree, but I also think it's like annoying. But then there's this part of me that's like, not everything is for everyone. Mm-hmm. What business do I have judging her review? When Christopher Nolan, is referencing her translation, what do I know about The Odyssey? Like, nothing. Mm-hmm. Literally, I didn't remember any of the plot when I went into the movie. So who am I to judge what she thinks of the movie when I'm consuming it from an entirely different perspective? Like, she's watching and reading it as an expert who knows this better than 99.999% of the world ever will.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reacting to it as like a consumer of pop culture. So yeah, and I don't know. I kind of like that you can have a lot of perspectives. I actually read a thread that perfectly encapsulates my feelings. So I want to shout out Zoe Sorrell at the handle at Flutes and Poems. She writes, I love it all, TBH. I love Nolan's Odyssey. I loved Emily Wilson's critique of Nolan's Odyssey. I love the layperson's glowing review of the film, the layperson's dissection of how they loathe the film. I love when art provokes strong feelings, and I love when we're moved to mine the deepest idiosyncrasies of humanity. I love that we would have done it different. I love that we wouldn't have changed a thing. I love that art has given us a direct rhetorical highway between 2026 and 700 BCE.
Yeah.
I think it's just beautiful.
That's great.
Like, the story has made it from ancient Greece to your office. And that's all people are it's something that we can all connect on. And I just think that it's like amazing that there's something so rich that even exists. Mm-hmm. So that's my feeling on it.
Yeah. I love a cranky academic too. Like there's something like in the right context, not at a cocktail party, but like, you know, in the right context, I love it when it's like, okay, this person who really knows their shit is engaging with it. But I also think that like a version of the Odyssey that engaged Emily Wilson would not necessarily have engaged as many people because she's operating on such a high level and she's so familiar with the material that like I think it would have maybe been inaccessible to a lot of people.
Also like days long. I don't see how you could actually fit all the things she, you know, said she wanted to fit in. Like, when would that all go?
Yeah. Well, one of her critiques was with, well, the fact that there is no sex is very funny because, like, in the Odyssey and the poem.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah. Like, in the poem, Odysseus sleeps with Circe. Like, there's, and he sleeps with her for, like, a year, I think. Like.
They have a baby.
Yeah. It's, like, kind of wild. I think that, like, you know, the no female characters thing is real. One of my biggest bugaboos with Christopher Nolan is that he seems so uncomfortable writing women that he just kind of doesn't. And in, like, Oppenheimer, like, I hated Oppenheimer.
I didn't like Oppenheimer either.
Hated it. It was the writing.
I couldn't watch it.
It was like a Wikipedia entry, like a high budget Wikipedia entry where it was like people just like reading. It was like, well, I'm Robert Oppenheimer. As you know, I'm your friend who's known you for 10 years. Well, in that 10 years, we've been through a lot. It was just like, why is this dialogue?
He's a bit of an expository writer. Yeah, I would say. But that's not like why you're seeing a Christopher Nolan movie.
No.
Or at least that's not why seeing one.
Yeah. You want it to be loud. You want it to be loud, explosions.
Some of Christopher Nolan's movies are my favorite movies, like The Prestige.
Oh, The Prestige is incredible. Yeah.
Incredible. And what I like in those movies is the way he like plays with time, similar to Memento also, where there's like this sort of reveal at the end. And I like it for that. And the problem to me is not that, like, Christopher Nolan can't write a woman. Like, could I write a male character that well? Like, probably not. My issue is that there's no space to support parody where, like, a great female director gets to, you know, play with such amazing source material as The Odyssey and then get to be held in such high regard. Mm-hmm. So it's like, Christopher, like, I'm not that surprised that Christopher Nolan can't write a female character. It's that there's no space in culture for that for a woman.
Mm-hmm. Well, like Greta Gerwig's Beowulf or something.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean.
For real.
That might be interesting. Actually, Greta Gerwig, if you're listening, you should pitch a Beowulf adaptation. If Christopher Nolan can do The Odyssey, you can do Beowulf. Okay.
Or like, I'm sure there's like a million epic things that maybe she'd want to get her, like something of that level. But the fact is, it's like Greta Gerwig's like one of the only female directors who we would name in that conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I like feel like I need Christopher Nolan to make a Greta Gerwig movie, but I would like more women to get the funding and the support to be able to take such big swings. And it's not just like this anomaly when like Barbie or Sinners comes out because it's like, oh, actually Black people see movies too? Wow. Mm-hmm. It's like, it shouldn't be such an astounding thing.
And yeah. I was going to say, it does feel very goldfish memory. Sort of like the, can women be funny and hot? It's like, yes, Lucille
right,
Ball.
We've done this.
Like we have done this so many times. Like, yes, we can. Why are we pretending that this doesn't happen all the time? Like, can women make blockbusters? Yes. Abso-fucking-lutely they can. And they have, like, recently. Like, can Black people make movies that other than white people want to see? Yes, they can. Why do we keep having this conversation over and over again? It almost feels like deliberate, practiced ignorance to justify excluding them until somebody breaks through and then act surprised like that. It just feels like part of the system that keeps white men at the top of the list of people who get the chance to make these things.
Well, just think about how, like, business gets done, like, what gets funded. Mm-hmm. Just men are more likely to, like, talk to men and give the people they know this funding or find it or have it. Like, they just have more money. And even with, okay, but even with Christopher Nolan, there's, you know, so he famously doesn't have he doesn't do email, he doesn't have a smartphone. And the reason is because his wife, his production partner, does all that stuff for him. Mm-hmm. And what I find to be offensive, even, is that he's the one whose name is going to get remembered as like this great artist. But that's all facilitated by his wife, who's most people will never know her name, and she's not getting credit for it. Yeah. And that's why I think that fucking girl could be the new series, because it's like, who is enabling that work? Like, was Michelangelo's wife actually, you know, taking on some ships at the Sistine Chapel? Why don't we talk about her?
Right.
It's like all these things just seem so absurd to me. Mm-hmm. And who are all the women who have been facilitating all of this? That's what I want to know.
I completely agree. And I just wanted to flag, there was a speech, a baseball player, I forget who it was being inducted into the Hall of Fame. And during his speech, he thanked his wife as like his most important teammate ever. He's like, everybody saw what I was doing on the field, but nobody saw what was happening behind the scenes, like, because she was raising our children and keeping our house and like making a life where that I could return to. I was able to do this. And like, you're my favorite, you know, I love you so much. You're my best teammate ever. Like, it was so sweet. And I feel like there's a pattern of that in history. And like, that's great. Like, I'm not saying that it always should be, that the man should never be allowed to excel, you know, but like Ruth Bader Ginsburg's husband kind of stayed home and put his career on the back burner because he was so interested in promoting her. I think same with Justice Jackson's husband, I believe is a physician, but he's so like, he would do anything to support his wife's career. I think that the partnership aspect of marriage often gives the glory to men and the work to women. And I think that's like a really good point. Like, I'm sure, you know, him and his Christopher Nolan and his wife work together, but Christopher Nolan is the name that everybody knows. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sani Petty. Hysteria is brought to you by Balesa. Stop what you're doing and listen closely, because Balesa and I are giving away free spicy toys or gift cards for every single one of you. That's right. Everyone who signs up wins something. If you haven't heard of Balesa, let me put you on. They're a top-rated sex toy company in North America, and they're hooking you up. You've definitely seen Balesa's popular toys all over your For You page, like their famous Whisper collection, you know, the first ever fully silent vibrators. If you live with roommates, parents, or even if your partner is sleeping right next to you, these toys are silent without compromising power. Looking to spice up date night? The Key Vibe is a discreet magnetic wearable that adds extra excitement. They've also got the Ultra Blow, their most advanced stroker yet, with powerful thrusting and rotating action, and the Halo 2, a compact couples toy designed to enhance intimacy together. And of course, I had to hook all of you up. So my friends at Balesa and I are sending out free toys or gift cards for toys to everyone who signs up. You heard that right. Every single one of you wins something. Just click the link in the episode description or head to bbvibes.com/hysteria. That's bbvibes.com/hysteria.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people who have been overwhelmed with horrific true crime stories this week and really wishes they could get back to Clam Slam content. I miss Kansas.
Seriously.
I miss Love Island. I miss the Clam Slamming. I miss the distraction, the candy-colored distraction. of something to watch right before going to bed and then not think about anything. I miss it.
That's how I feel about Summer House. I miss it.
I have a friend who watched, like, who started reading about the Summer House controversy, and she was like, I want to get into this. And she went back and watched all of it. She, like, watched all of Summer House, and now she's caught up, and she's like, what do I do with myself now?
Right. It's like you've lived in Summer House. It's like when you finish a book you really like, and you're like, wait, where'd the people go?
Exactly. Before we get to Sandy Petty, some announcements for the class. Crooked Media has an exciting new limited series to share with you. It's called Long Play. The South is the new epicenter of American politics. It's the fastest growing region in the country, and its power in Congress and the Electoral College is growing too. And now, changes to the Voting Rights Act have raised the stakes even higher. For both major parties, the path to winning America runs through the South. But to win it, you have to understand it. Long Play is a limited series from the folks who brought you Showtime's The Circuit. Across six southern states, Long Play examines the issues driving voters, the assumptions that no longer hold, what the rest of the country is missing about a region that could shape the future of our politics and our country. It is really excellent work from Emmy-nominated host and Southerner Jennifer Palmieri, former mayor of New Orleans Mitch Landrieu, and award-winning journalist Aaron Haynes. Hey, we know her. Friend of Hysteria. From Left Right TV and Crooked Media, watch Long Play now on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get podcasts. Now let's get to Sandy Petty. Okay, Sammy, yours is serious. I know what yours is. I've had a preview. So I'm going to do my stupid one first and then let you do your more serious one. So Nike recently introduced what it is describing as an updated take on workout wear from Nike and Skims, a collaboration between Nike and the Kardashian family brand of skinny clothes. It says, built for the body in motion, styled for everywhere, arriving July 30th. And there's a picture accompanying it. I'm going to say there was this dance hit with a video that went pretty viral when I was in college called Call On Me, which is a remix of the song Valerie. And Call On Me featured women in like 80s workout gear and like thongs doing very suggestive, like aerobics inspired moves. If you've seen that video, this outfit looks inspired by the video, but minus the really fun 80s colors and 80s hair. It is like a wrestling singlet over a bandeau top. That appears to have like a kind of thong-like cut within the shorts, so it gives you, make sure that your two butt cheeks are distinct as you wear it. I cannot think of anything that I would want to work out in less than this. Like, bodies in motion. Where are they going? To the circus?
They're not staying in motion.
They're not
this is one of those things where I look at it and like, I genuinely am just like, ugh. Like, so boring, so stupid, so, like, meant to provoke a reaction that I'm just like, next. Like, I hate this kind of thing where it's like, you're just such, like, capitalist sellouts. Can you make something interesting?
It's so
uninteresting. They think this is interesting.
And I just don't, it looks more like lingerie.
It's like a costume.
Yeah,
it's
it does.
So stupid.
It does look like a costume, like a superhero in a porn, like, parody of superheroes. And also, but I will say this, here's the sanity among the petty, because this looks really dumb, and I think a lot of people agree with me. All the commenters on the Instagram post from Nike Women agree with me. They're very funny. One of them said, is this the Borat edition?
It's so true.
Another person said, is the motion in the room with us? one note, Nike, try making not for the male gaze, that's all. One person said that they would wear it at the end of their shift. Is this late April Fools? Who in the world is wearing this to the gym? More clothes designed for the landfill. I'm on the Mad Max timeline now. Yes.
It's very like, it looks like something like someone would wear to post a video of them skiing in Aspen, mm-hmm. wearing that and like a big furry hat. And it's just so tacky and annoying. I mean, if Nike had done something with Skims, it could maybe be a respectable, cool collection. And this is what you do? Mm-hmm. I don't have time for it.
Yeah, it's I don't think anybody has time for it. But it's barely got any fabric to it. Something I think that what would I wear?
High margins.
I mean,
I'd wear it to a costume party.
I would. Yeah. You know what? I would wear this. I would make this the bet in a fantasy football league where if you lose, you have to wear that outfit out to just like run errands. That would be,
okay.
Yeah, like be really funny.
But then okay. You have to buy it.
Then you had, well, I mean, among the
in
fantasy,
theory.
The league would pool their money and they would buy one of them at the end of the and then the last place person would have to wear it. I think that would be an appropriate use of this costume for people who lose bets. All right, Sammy, what are you feeling petty about or what is giving you sanity this week?
I am feeling petty and it is very much giving me the opposite of sanity. Have you been following Max Miller in Congress?
Yes, unfortunately. He's like one of those people. I wish I didn't know who he was.
I wish he didn't
exist.
But yeah. Yeah. Like he'd be torturing someone no matter where he was, is what I've learned about this man. He is a congressman. He just got elected in 2022 after being one of Trump's senior aides for his first administration. He got his job because Trump endorsed him to primary someone who voted against Trump being impeached for January 6th. So, yeah. He also is married to the daughter of Ohio Senator Bernie Moreno, or was married. They're now exes. But we have learned through, like, I think 2,000 pages of court documents and police reports that he was allegedly extremely abusive towards her and potentially to their 2-year-old daughter, whose collarbone he may have broken.
Oh my God.
He allegedly held a gun to his ex-wife's head while she was changing the daughter's diaper. The daughter had said something like, once said to her, like, "Daddy, kill mommy." Like, crazy abuse. Like he threw boiling water on her. Like, and the thing is, like, yes, that is this case, but he has a whole history of like abuse and drinking and driving and like just really, really like dangerous.
He's like, a piece
not
of
just
shit.
Deplorable behavior, but like genuinely violent, dangerous behavior.
Uh-huh.
Like really gross.
Okay, and so
like,
is Senator Moreno doing anything about this? Is he saying anything to support his daughter? What?
So this is like, no, he's not. No Republican has said anything about this.
Oh, I mean, and predictable, but like disgusting.
Predictable. But even her own father, he and Max Miller have had issues. Like Max Miller got into a fight with like Bernie Moreno's attorney. Like this man cannot have an engagement that doesn't seem to devolve into violence. So Bernie Moreno's not even saying anything. And I think this is where I'm feeling petty. This could Max Miller is up for re-election, as he is every 2 years, and he could possibly lose a very safe district because of this. And I feel that that is probably why Bernie Moreno is not saying anything.
Oh, that's so
I mean, he's
gross.
Not, I don't think he's like close to losing, but like it's definitely not doing him any favors there.
I mean, no longer being a congressperson is the least that should happen to somebody who has committed this level of like, it's like trashy violence. Like it is like human trash violence. Like a fist fight with your father-in-law's lawyer.
He belongs on an island. Like he is a danger. He is a man on the loose.
Yes.
A reckless man on the loose.
Yeah.
Who we all know is out there is Ruben Gallego doing stuff like this.
Well, just Jared Leto. Loose. People who are just like, oh yeah, he's just kind of a wild guy. And we're just not
right.
Gonna-
Oh, that's just Donald Trump is a man on the loose. Like they're all just men on the loose.
I love that phraseology, Sammy. That's really I'm going to start using it. Did you come up with that?
I did. Honestly, it's more in my head. I've never like said it as this is my phrase, but it's like the way I think of Pete Hegseth is a man on the loose, RFK Jr. It's like where men that women would have a whisper network about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and consequences just evade them.
Forever.
Oh my God.
Max Miller, man on the loose.
He is just, ugh, God, he's so gross. And I really hope that the people of Ohio are able to at least give him like some punishment at the electoral booth, you know?
I am just waiting for his ex-father-in-law to weigh in.
I mean, it's so gross and craven that you would be like, oh, we got an election to win though. I'm not gonna say anything. Oh, I don't like it. I don't like
even
it.
Even though he almost could have killed my daughter.
Yeah. Ugh. Oh, yuck. I don't like that.
I mean, the psychological study of what must be going on in that family.
Also, how many people in the Trump administration, like both one and two, have been like credibly accused of violence against women specifically. Like, so many. It's like a basketball team's worth.
You know Stephanie Grisham, who worked for during the first Trump administration? Mm-hmm. He dated her during the first Trump administration, and she didn't name him, but it's clear that it was him, that like someone who she dated during that administration was abusive to her, and it was him.
Oh my God. Okay.
I don't think he can walk into a relationship without being.
Oh my God. Well, who is he who's running against him? Do we know the name of the
good
person?
Good question.
We need to put a shout. We'll put a link to that person.
Brian Poindexter, an iron worker, Brian Poindexter, Ohio 7.
Okay.
Who lives in Ohio 7. He's endorsed by the Working Families Party.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know what?
Brian
for Congress. This is the only thing we know about him is he's running against Max Miller. And Brian for Congress.
It would be hard to meet the level of terribleness that Max Miller is.
Yeah. Yeah. He's pretty awful. Well, I would say that's probably more than a petty thing. But the Bernie Moreno thing is definitely petty because he should not be such a little pipsqueak. He's such a little coward. Like, have a backbone, dude. Didn't you used to sell? He used to sell cars. He should be comfortable confronting people. That's what closing a sale is. It's confrontation.
He's a freshman senator.
Man, Ohio, get your shit together. I know there's good people who live in Ohio. I've got a couple friends who live there. Get your shit together,
Ohio's
guys.
Ohio's legit.
That's all the time we have for this week's episode of Hysteria. Sammy Sage, thank you so much for joining me and guest hosting this week. Listeners, if you want to get in touch, hysteria@crooked.com is the email address. We also want to thank Dr. Annie Andrews for joining us for the interview. And there will be more Hysteria for you next week. Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Caroline Reston, Claire Fogarty, Kendra James, Adrian Hill, Alyssa Mastromonaco, and me, Erin Ryan. Our team includes Matt DeGroat, Rachel Gajewski, Delon Villanueva, Claudia Sheng, Mia Kelman, Jay Banks, Charlotte Landis, and Jordan Cantor. Our staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no-bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to. Journalists, politicians, experts, comedians and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply stupid.
Doesn't sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no-bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to. Journalists, politicians, experts, comedians and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.